Every 10 seconds, a new small business is started. Every day, more and more people are deciding they want to be their own boss and making huge sacrifices to live out their dreams. Yet, they have no place to turn for support. Entrepreneurs of the world, unite and let's talk business.
This is Dr. Dennis Waitley. You're listening to Let's Talk Business, which I think is probably the most important show that you can listen to on becoming an entrepreneur in a fast-forward world.
The Let's Talk Business Network is dedicated to helping entrepreneurs and small business owners succeed. So get ready to be helped, informed, and inspired, because it's time for Let's Talk Business with veteran entrepreneur and a man who was voted one of the 100 most important talk show hosts, Mitch Schlimmer.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Let's Talk Business. I'm your host, Mitch Schlimmer, and if you're just tuning in, you're listening to WREK right here in beautiful Atlanta, 91.1 on your FM dial, 100,000 watts of power, and this show is all about entrepreneurship and innovation and a subject I love, which is also youth empowerment, and we love to hear from you and to take your calls. You can always feel free to call us at 404-894-2468 or send me email to mitch@ltbn.com, and I know that my two featured guests would love to hear from you as well. And I've got two great guests joining us. First, from St. Louis, is none other than Shep Hyken, an entrepreneur, public speaker, and so much more. And if anyone understands customers and serving customers and creating great experience, it is Shep. And then followed by Shep, we're going to have none other than entrepreneur Mo Siegel joining us all the way from Colorado. And we're going to actually talk about Mo's journey. Mo, at the age of 20, founded a Celestial Seasonings and actually created a whole industry in the world of tea. Well, as I mentioned, my first guest really is an incredible guy, and it is Shep Hyken, and he is a customer experience expert. Matter of fact, he's actually the chief amazement officer of Shepherd Presentations. He is a New York Times and Wall Street Journal best-selling author, and matter of fact, he's actually even in the National Speakers Association Hall of Fame. He's done some incredible things. He's written some great books, and his latest book is out called The Amazement Revolution, 7 Customer Service Strategies to Create an Amazing Customer and Even Employee Experience. Shep, welcome to Let's Talk Business.
Hey, Mitch, thanks for having me here. I'm excited. This is a wonderful show.
Shep, how you doing?
I am doing great. Thanks for having me on the show. Terrific show.
I tell you what, I was really excited last night. I was reading The Amazement Revolution and actually couldn't wait to have you and also Mo Siegel on today, as this show is all about entrepreneurship. And, you know, when you look back to your journey, and again, 1983, you are an entrepreneur. You've been running a very successful business, obviously, here for decades. And we want to get to know Shep. We want to get to know your journey. One of the things that a lot of my listeners know, Shep, is that since you're on for a half hour, we have the luxury of getting to know you. So why don't we start off here and let's go back to those really early days. You know, you're 12 years old, you know, you like magic, your entrepreneurial career kind of starts right there.
Well, I was born into a family of entrepreneurs. My father had his own business. My grandpa was a pharmacist, had his own drugstore. My other grandpa had gasoline stations. So, I mean, we're used to working on our own. My first job, by the way, was working at the drugstore when I was 8 years old. My grandpa told me he'd pay me 50 cents, and I thought it was 50 cents a day. But when I got that first paycheck, and it was like at the end of the day for $4.50, I went, what's this? 9 hours, 50 cents, wow. But at age 12, I did truly start my first business, the birthday party magic show business. I'd been doing magic for a couple of years, and really, that's where it all started. Somebody called me and said, would you do my kid's birthday party? Right? That was it. And I was hooked.
Well, I tell you what's interesting is, you know, not only were you hooked, but, you know, you learned some lessons from your parents. And obviously, some of those are, you know, following up and the importance of a thank you. But I really want to get into your journey. So now you're growing up. Let's really talk about the evolution here of Shep and the different businesses that you've built and how it led to this book as well.
Sure. And back to your comment about the lessons I learned, I think these are great lessons for any entrepreneur. My mom, from the moment I could start writing, had me writing thank you notes to anybody that did anything nice, gave me a gift or whatever. And when I came home from that first day of doing that birthday party, I'm sitting around the kitchen table and my mom says, "What are you going to do now?" And I knew what she was getting at, and I said, "I'm going to go write a thank you note to the woman that hired me to do her son's birthday party." And that was just a metaphor, really, for doing the right thing. And even today, we all know how powerful a handwritten or a typewritten, even an email to an extent, if it's personalized, it's a very powerful way of showing appreciation. My dad chimed in and said, "If you're really going to take this serious," as I started to do more and more of these birthday parties, he says, "You need to think about a couple of things. Number one, you need to call the parents to let them know that you're going to show up on time, that you know where the house is." And I did that about a week ahead of time. And little did I know that's called confidence creation. And people want to do business, and this is a cliche, Mitch, you know the answer. People want to do business with people they know, like, and
trust.
Exactly. And we're going to try and build that trust and get them to know us and like us from the confidence that we build. So when I made that call, the parents knew, okay, Shep's probably going to show up. Not only did I show up, I showed up early. And my dad said, "You got to work hard." And he said something pretty cool. He said, "You're doing this probably for the 500th time. You practice all the time. Those kids and the parents, they're seeing it for the first time. So make it special." So I'd show up early, I'd work hard, and I'd always stay late, giving them a little bit more value. My dad used to joke. He says, "Why don't you show up late and leave early to make up for it?" We probably have a few employees that work with us that are like that. But anyway, I would stay late, give them value, and then I'd go home and I'd write a thank you note. And about a year or so later, my dad said, "You know, we're missing one little extra thing we want to do." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "Call about a week afterwards. The party's happened. They've received a thank you note. Make sure you did a good job. Find out, you know, get customer feedback, if you will. But more importantly, that's your opportunity to ask, hey, I noticed there was a brother or a sister. Are they going to have a party? And when is it? Or I noticed there were some other parents there. Any chance you can give me their name and number so I can call them to see if they're interested in me doing their party?" And that was really how my whole sales career started. And I don't care what we do, what we call ourselves, there's some element of selling whatever it is we do. And this was just a great lesson that my parents taught me from a very young age.
Well, I tell you, it's a great foundation, and not every kid learns those lessons. Not everyone learns them in general. Forget about being a kid. So now you've gone through school, and maybe we can talk just a little bit about, you know, your entrepreneurial career here, and then we're going to get into the amazement revolution. So why don't you go ahead?
So, you know, my family had a little bit of a business. They had some gas stations, and growing up, my mom was smart. I was making a lot of money doing these magic shows. And as I got into being 16, 17 years old, I actually could drive myself and started working in nightclubs. But mom was smart and made sure that I had a real job to understand the real value of hard work. Because frankly, in the entertainment business, even as a magician, you know, as a kid, getting $75 to $100 for an hour for a birthday party, you know, it's not quite the same as a rock star who gets paid $500,000 to walk on stage for an hour and a half. But, you know, it's you can become very, disenfranchised from the rest of the world, thinking things are different. You know, it's not reality. So I was grounded from the standpoint of my parents made me get a regular job during the summer. Went to college, graduated college, realized I wasn't going to be working for the family business. Saw a couple of motivational speakers, and I thought, wow, I've got entertainment background. I've got a little bit of business, and you know, I've got the work ethic. I'm going to write a speech, and I'm going to go see if I can sell this to the corporate world. And that was in 1983. And I picked up the phone. Literally, I started smiling and dialing. I went to the newsstand, and I bought every business news or magazine that there was. And there was probably maybe five or six of them. I ripped out all the full-page ads. My thought process was simply this. They've got a full-page ad. They're selling something. They're selling something. Maybe they have a sales force. If they have a sales force, maybe they have a meeting. If they have a meeting, maybe they'll hire a speaker. That was it. And I just picked up the phone and started calling all of these companies. Now, 1983, this is before the Internet, so I actually had to research and find out where these companies were, and I just, you know, made a pile of phone numbers and lists of people to call, and that's how it started.
And the rest is history, as they say. As you and I know, you know, you've worked with hundreds of clients, ranging from Fortune 100 size organizations to companies with 50 or less employees. And, you know, some of them, as we both know, were American Airlines and Anheuser-Busch, AT&T, Aetna, and American Express, and the list goes on and on. And as I said earlier, you know, he was actually inducted into the National Speakers Association Hall of Fame for lifetime achievement in the speaking profession, and he's a marvelous speaker. One of the things, Shep, that in getting to the meat of, you know, yourself and obviously customer service is the subject of amazement. So what is amazement and what is the amazement revolution?
Sure. I, from, you know, think back of my background, magic. So I was doing these magic shows and I moved into speaking. And even today, I still incorporate magic into the speech as a fun way. And by the way, it's just an accent. It's like how a speaker tells a story. So I use words like, you know, creating moments of magic, which are positive interactions for the customer. So the concept of amazement grew out of that. If you take this moment of truth, this moment in front of your customer, and you make it positive, that's a moment of magic. If you can string a bunch of these frontline contacts together, that customer says, okay, I can predict that every time I work with this company or whoever it is, it will be a positive experience. And I basically said it's going to be an amazing experience, because today especially, to create, when people say, oh, they've got great service, really they may have great over-the-top service, but typically what people are saying when they refer to somebody who has great service is that they're just better than everybody else, which what's out there? What's out there is typically average or mediocre. To be amazing, all you have to do is just be a little bit better than average. That's it. So if you can be consistently and predictably better than average, you are operating in the zone of amazement. The amazement revolution is just a phrase. You know, I love words like revolution and magic and you know, creating evangelists. But the revolution is this. Let's get everybody on board and figure out a way to make every contact that we have with our customers as well as our internal customers to be better than average. In other words, amazing.
Well, when I think of Shep Hyken, one of the things I think about, Shep, is do the right thing. Maybe you can discuss that.
Sure. You know, again, doing the right thing to me is common sense. Common sense, unfortunately, is not always so common when you deal with companies. Now, doing the right thing, give you an example of this. You're getting ready to take your car in to get service. Don't you think it's reasonable that if you call and make an appointment, that they would be ready for you when you got there? They would know that you're bringing your car in, so the check-in process would be quick. Maybe they'd give you a loaner car, since they're going to keep your car all day, or at least offer to give you a ride when you make the reservation. When you go to pick up your car, you pick it up when they told you it would be ready, and it is ready, and it's waiting, and perhaps they've even washed the car. Now, to me, doesn't that seem like pretty much common sense?
Obviously.
Okay. Well, the best brands and car dealerships, and I would say the top 10%, and J.D. Powers did some surveys on this, but the best brands know that that's the right thing to do. They know it's common sense. By the way, so do the other dealerships that aren't doing it. But guess what? They're not doing it. Why aren't they doing it? They don't get it. They need to be, again, better than average all of the time, and they need to focus on really doing the right thing. What's right for the customer? Because if you want that repeat business, if you want loyalty, the only way you're going to get it is by creating confidence, as we mentioned before, and doing the right thing and making sure that that right thing is predictable and consistent every time a customer works with you.
Well, one of the things I love about you and your work, actually, and again, listeners, we're talking to Shep Hyken, joining us all the way from St. Louis, and he has penned another book, a New York Times bestseller, called The Amazement Revolution, 7 Customer Service Strategies to Create an Amazing Customer and Even Employee Experience. And Shep, to me, that's at the heart of this book, is the 7 customer service strategies to create an amazing customer experience. Let's talk about these 7 different strategies, because I want to make sure that my listeners really get them. So why don't we start off and start with number 1?
Sure. Number 1 is the concept of creating membership or a membership experience. And this is really cool. I have an American Express credit card, and on the card it says Member Since 1983. I got the card when I went into business. And they treat, and they like to treat, their customers or refer to their customers as members. Reality is, we're customers, and we're paying a fee to use this card. But their whole mindset is, we want to create a membership experience. That's where the essence of this chapter came from. If you go to a gym, people say you join a gym, and the gym charges you a monthly fee to come and use their equipment. In a sense, that's a membership fee. Well, what they're trying to do is make you feel like you're doing business with a place that's special, that has some exclusivity to it. Even though virtually anybody can join the gym, they want you to know that, you know, you're a member. You don't have to call your customers members. You just have to treat them in such a way that makes them feel special. It may be as simple as using their name and remembering them when they come in, but you make them feel special and make them feel like they're doing business with a place that's special. That's the whole concept in a real short synopsis of what membership is.
So let's go to number 2, which is have serious fun.
Yep. This is internal. You know, the title of the book talked about an experience for, you know, customers and employees. Serious fun does not necessarily mean, ha-ha, let's go out and have a good time. Fun is an acronym for fulfilling, uniqueness, and next. Are we fulfilling our employees? In other words, are they coming? Are they enjoying working with us? Do we exploit their unique talents? Do they have some special talent that they're really great at that we make sure that they can use while they're working? And are they excited about what's next? And it could be the next project, the next client, the next big invention we're going to have, or just coming back for the next day. Brian Keeley at Baptist Health down in Florida, he has a great concept. He's the CEO of this large hospital chain or healthcare chain, and he says, anybody that comes to work here, I want this to be their final place that they work. We're a destination employer, and if we keep our employees fulfilled, they'll keep wanting to come back, and they will treat our customers, who are the patients and the family members of the patients, they'll treat them right. And it's, you know, the concept of what's happening on the inside of a company is being felt on the outside of the company. So let's create an internal focused culture, and it doesn't matter if you have 1 or 2 people that work for you or you have thousands of people. If people are happy about working for you and they're willing to work hard and they're excited, the customers on the outside are going to feel it.
So let's go to number 3 now, which is cultivate partnership.
Yep. Partnership is loyalty on steroids. I have a definition of what loyalty is. And it came about because I always thought in my mind, here's what we're trying to get. We're trying to get loyal customers. I've written articles that you don't want to satisfy your customers. You want to create loyalty. Satisfactory is average. Well, partnership is loyalty on steroids. And here's my point. Somebody may say, yes, I'm loyal to that company, but do they give me 100% of their business? No, they just will keep coming back. If true partnership means I wouldn't consider doing business with anybody else that does what it is that you do or what you sell. I have a friend of mine, Matthew Porter, who has a company called Contigix. This is my lead case study in this book. And by the way, each of the strategies have 7 specific case studies or corporate examples, so we can learn just not like here's a strategy, but here's how 7 companies are doing this. But Matthew's company, one night, one of his clients, they're in the business of servers and computers and you know, managing all of the internet and computer power for companies. Well, one of his clients didn't have enough power. In other words, their bandwidth wasn't wide enough, and they had a surge of customers calling and contacting them via the internet, and what was going to happen is the system was going to shut down. they could not reach the decision maker. Contigic's people couldn't. So what they did is they added extra equipment, thinking that hopefully when they finally talk to this client that they're going to say, hey, thanks for doing this. Sure, we'll be happy to pay for it. But knowing that they might not. And of course, Monday morning came along and they finally were able to reach the client. The client was overwhelmingly happy that Contigic did what they did and said, of course, we'll pay for it. And by the way, if that's the way you think about us, that you're willing to put yourself out there and take a risk, we want to do business with you and only do business with you. And that's pretty powerful. What happened is Contigic made the customer's problem their problem, and they solved it if it was theirs. Beautiful idea.
Well, I tell you, it's my favorite part of the book is actually these 50 different stories and role models for everyone to listen to. Again, listeners, go out and get the book, The Amazement Revolution. You're going to love it. You can also learn a lot about Shep at his website at www.hyken, that's hyken.com. Well, Shep, let's go to number four here, because as I said, this is the meat of the book, which is hire right.
Right. This is hiring. This is an internally focused strategy. You want to hire the right people. You want to make sure you're getting the right person for the right job. And, you know, there's this old cliche, hire the attitude, train the skill. But I think it's a really powerful concept. If I give you an example, an American Express is not just a great case study in the book. I have devoted an entire chapter to American Express using all seven of these strategies. But what they did was absolutely fascinating. They said, you know, we're running call centers, and the most important thing when we get off the phone with a customer isn't that we just resolved their problem, isn't that we did it in a time of, you know, a timely and efficient manager's call so we can move on to the next call. No, they are only interested in making sure when they get off the phone that that customer or member is happy with them. And they recognize that anybody with call center experience came from a background where the metrics are resolve the problem, move on to the next call. How many calls can you get to in a finite period of time? And American Express says, no, we want to build the relationship. So we're going to start hiring people outside of the call center world. They hired people from hotels who had, you know, hospitality experience, servers at restaurants who had experience dealing with people, and they found that these people skills were really important. Another great case study in the book was the Fudgery, which is a small chain of retail fudge stores, and they make the fudge right in front of you. And you may have seen these at a mall. But what these employees do is they sing and they kind of dance as they're making it, and it's incredible. And I went up to the manager and I said, how is it that, I mean, how do you get these people? And he said, before they're ever allowed to fill out an application, they have to audition for the job. Like, what do you mean, audition? He says, yeah, we actually hold an audition, put them in front of a camera, give them some lights, and let them sing. And I said, oh, what happens if they don't sing very well? He says, it doesn't matter. As long as they're willing to sing, we're looking for the right attitude, the right kind of person that we want. And that's just, you know, very important. Hire the right people for the right job. If you don't, the people will eventually implode. They'll treat people around them wrong. They'll treat the customer wrong because they're not going to be happy at the end of the day with their job.
Matter of fact, I actually think they're from Georgia. And yes. This show is heard throughout Atlanta right here on 91.1 on your FM dial, 100,000 watts right here on WREK, and you're listening to Let's Talk Business. I'm your host, Mitch Schlimmer, and joining me from beautiful St. Louis is none other than Shep Hyken, and we're talking about his journey. We're talking about, obviously, great customer service and his book, The Amazement Revolution. Well, let's move on here, Shep, to number five, which is create a memorable after experience.
Right. The after experience, we'll go back to the very beginning of our interview. That's that thank you note. That's what happens after we do whatever it is we do. And again, a thank you note, email. But some of the case studies that I shared with do a little bit more than that. And it's not that they have to be expensive after experiences. And I'll give you an example. A friend of mine who's a Speakers Bureau agent, Brian Lord at Premier Speakers Bureau, out of Nashville, Tennessee. He knew that his client loved baseball and specifically loved a specific baseball player. And he went on eBay and he bought an autographed baseball for about $20-something. And he sent this to his client after he had booked some speakers just as a way of saying thanks. And it was a very personalized gift, not from the standpoint of personalized with the engraving of their name of either the customer or the bureau, but no, it's personalized in that Brian thought about what this guy really loved, and he gave him something that was personal and didn't cost very much at all. And the concept behind the after experience is it's unexpected, memorable, and appreciated. Unexpected, memorable, and appreciated. Doesn't have to be expensive, although some people want to send extravagant gifts. That's fine. Send them my way. But overall, it could be as simple as a thank you note. My wife received a note from her OR team for a little procedure she had done a few years ago. 3 days after she's home, it's like a little get-well card, and thanks for letting us take care of you. And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. We've never forgotten that. So it's that simple, the after experience. Very powerful.
Build community next.
Build community is about creating your tribe, getting people involved with you. Harley Davidson, who was going out of business at one point, said, what can we do? They went and talked to their people, their customers. They found out what their customers wanted. They engaged with them, and then they made a promise to the customers that they would deliver, and they did, and the customers started buying again. Amazon.com creates book clubs for people that have special interests. They create these communities. Apple Computer creates a forum for people to go on and talk about the various Apple products, and it's a way of building a community and getting people involved with you.
And last of all, walk the walk, Shep.
This one's powerful. This is about being a leader, regardless of your leadership position. You can just be the newest employee. Set the example. Walt Disney set the example as the guy that ran this great empire. If he walked by a piece of trash, he did what I called stoop to excellence, which he stooped down and he picked up the piece of trash, basically exemplifying that, hey, if I do it, you should do it too. And everybody should walk the walk. And there's this golden rule, do unto others as you want done unto yourself. Well, the employee golden rule is do unto your fellow employees and treat your fellow employees the way you want the customer treated, or behave the way you want everybody to behave toward the customer and the environment they're in. And that's what this is about, you know, setting the tone, you know, showing that you are as good as you are and walking the walk when it comes to service.
Well, there's a lot that I've learned from you and obviously reading your book. And you know, one of those things you talk about, you know, which is, as you're kind of alluding to, which is treat your customers the way they should and want to be treated, and they will come back again and again. And as you said earlier here, Shep, be consistently better than the average. And, you know, the whole key is to do just do more. It's really not that difficult. It's almost like that famous Woody Allen quote about success and just showing up. But in wrapping up here, Shep, I mean, it is not luck that you are in the National Speakers Hall of Fame. And a lot of people are very fearful of speaking, but speaking is very powerful and really can be marvelous to help your career and your brand. Just give us a few tips on what it takes to be really a successful public speaker.
Well, I think most importantly is to be prepared. And that means knowing what you're going to talk about, somewhat rehearsed. You don't want to walk up. I mean, you can walk up with notes, but you don't want to walk up not knowing what you're going to talk about. People say, do you get nervous? And today, I always get nervous out of the excitement, but I only get truly nervous if I feel that I haven't prepared properly. I will do everything in my power to not have that sick feeling in my stomach. So I worked hard to prepare. Again, not necessarily memorize, but make sure I know what I'm talking about and understand who my audience is.
Any other real quick tips? I mean, you're in that Hall of Fame. Preparation is really key. Anything else, buddy?
Well, you know, you mentioned that speaking can help your career. You know, if you do anything, you can get up and talk about it and educate customers, educate your employees. But, you know, one of the other things you might want to consider, and I think for virtually any business, is writing a book. It doesn't have to be a New York Times bestseller, and it can be a booklet that's, you know, 16 pages long with a staple in it. But people like to get information, and put together properly, this information is better than a brochure because it talks about, you know, it educates the customer. It should be focused on who the reader is, not just a showcase. But if you do something like this, I believe that's your expensive business card. That's the best thing that you can do. When you receive my book, a tremendous amount of credibility, yes?
No question about it. Matter of fact, the word author comes from the word authority, and it helps position you as an authority in the space that you write about.
Exactly, and I think that's a perfect way to make that point.
Well, I tell you what, Shep, I really enjoyed having you on today, and it really was a joy. I look forward to getting to know you, and I think back to when you were 12 years old and your parents, and you know, those six things they taught you, everything from showing up early to do your best, to stay late, to always say thank you, give people more than they expect, and that follow-up, a foundation that I'm hoping all my listeners will put into place today, especially all the young listeners from all over the world that listen to Let's Talk Business and our My Ultimate Life radio network here. And so, Shep, hopefully you enjoyed yourself.
Oh, I did. Fantastic. And I believe that anybody that does the six concepts that you just mentioned, they will be operating at the level of amazement.
Do the right thing. And that's the big message. And Shep, thank you, buddy.
Thank you. Congratulations on a wonderful show. I'm honored to be on it. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank, of course, Shep for such a great time. And as I mentioned, go to his website. I think you're going to learn an awful lot. And our second featured guest is joining us all the way from beautiful Colorado. And you want to talk about entrepreneur. You want to talk about the real deal. You want to talk about an entrepreneur who created a whole industry. Well, our guest is none other than Mo Siegel. And back in 1969, 70-ish, he co-founded Celestial Seasonings, which actually became the largest manufacturer of specialties in North America. And he's had absolutely an incredible journey. And we're going to explore his journey, and we're going to learn a lot from Mo. Mo, welcome to Let's Talk Business.
Well, thank you, Mitch. It's good to be here.
I tell you what, I am so glad that we finally have got you on. I'm a big fan of the products. I know you've been out of the company for a good while, but that journey and what you created is something that I love to share. This radio show is Let's Talk Business. It's heard here, right here on WREK 91.1 on your FM dial in Atlanta and throughout the world on the internet at www.wrek.org. And I'm a big proponent, Mo, of what I call OPE, other people's experiences, and learning from their journey. So here you are, all of 20 years of age. It's 1969, 1970, and you are starting a small little business. Why don't you tell us a little bit about those early years, and then we'll start to get into further on, including the fact that in 1986 you actually even retired.
I retired, but Mitch, I came back.
No, and I know, and we're going to explore that. So let's start off. You're 20 years of age. What did you guys see? What were you looking to do?
Well, in 1969, I was living in Aspen, Colorado, and I hike. Last night, we had the first snowstorm here in Colorado. I'm looking out my window right now, and there's a good foot of snow. Probably not like that in Atlanta today. The mountains have been in my blood since I was a young boy. I was born and raised in the mountains, and I've been a hiker, and I've climbed lots of mountains. I'm a mountain climber by a hobby. And back then, I didn't have any money. And so I'd go to school, and then I'd go to college, and then I'd go work because I had no money. And I ended up borrowing a little money and worked with a guy with a natural food store in Aspen. And we used to give away free tea as people walked into the store. And I was hiking the mountains and realized that the herbs that we were selling, the tea that we were selling and tea that we were giving away, was growing in the mountains. So in that summer, in 1969, I went out with botanists. And I can't explain, Mitch, why a 19-year-old kid would be going out with a botanist and learning about the wild plants, except they were free. That might have been it. They were free. So I started picking these wild herbs and making up teas, and my friend said, boy, that is so good. You really ought to sell that tea. So that summer was a summer of exploration and fun and learning how to make tea. And the next year, I didn't really plan that I was going to go into the tea business, but I ended up picking wild herbs again, and again, everybody said, you really ought to sell that stuff. It's so good, and I had moved down to Boulder, Colorado, and So I got a couple of friends, three friends, to help me pick tea that summer. And we picked 19 bales of tea, or gunny sacks, big gunny sacks of tea. And I thought I had made a sale. Mitch, it was my first great business lesson. One store took it all. But I really didn't know at that age what was the difference between consignment and a sale. So they took all the tea, and they still owe me for 9 gunny sacks worth of tea. I went off that winter and down into South America, and I came back to Colorado in the spring to find out that they had repackaged the tea from these big gunny sacks, and I had called it 36 herb tea because it was wild herbs. I don't think I was clear about this. Those two summers, all the tea that I gathered were gathered in the mountains, hand-picked, down on your hands and knees, plucking flowers in the meadows of Colorado. And I came back, and they had taken the name 36 Herb Tea, renamed it to Moe's 36 Herb Tea, and sold it in little bags across the state. They'd taken the big gunny sacks and made, you know, thousands of little bags of tea. And I was as surprised as anybody that there was a pretty big following for the tea. So that year, this is going into my third summer, I met a guy named John Hay, and John had moved from New York, and John had the big bucks to really get going. So he and I talked and decided that going into the tea business was a good idea. So he sold his car, and he had $500 left over. And that was the seed capital for the third year of the tea business, the big money.
The big money sold his Volkswagen.
He did, no, actually had a little sports car, but he ended up with $500. You got it, man. He bought a Volkswagen. So that year we were back in the woods picking tea, and that was in Colorado, and there was a small group of us that were doing it. We only had $500, and we bought cloth and hand cut out 10,000 cloth bags with pinking shears and picked all these herbs. We went to 24, not 36, so it was most 24 of tea. We picked the tea in the mountains and bagged it up into these bags and started going into the natural food stores, the health food stores then. And the health food industry really didn't exist, or the natural foods industry didn't exist. There were pill shops, but there weren't natural food stores. And so I drove to New York in the fall and started selling tea. And I went into my first store in Chicago, Mitch, and I was such a health food fanatic. I was crazed. And I wanted the healthiest, best stuff in the world. So back then there was this purple ink. I don't know if you ever saw it, where they used to stamp meat with a purple stamp. It was a USDA seal that said the meat was okay. And I figured, well, if you could eat that ink on the meat, it'd probably be okay on the outside of the package. So I go into my first health food store in Chicago. I hand the proprietor this bag. This bag's about a 3-ounce bag of Moe's 24 Herb Tea. On the front is this kind of pretty label. It was hand-stamped from a rubber stamp. We stamped the bags. On the back of the 24 ingredients and something about this company, he's looking at it. He's holding it in his hand. He's a sole proprietor. He's been stocking the shelves. His hands are a little sweaty. And I'm sticking a Tupperware container of Red Zinger underneath his nose and saying in 3 years we're going to be the largest specialty tea company in the United States, herbal tea company. And he gives me back the bag, and there are the ingredients on his hand. It turns out that if you could eat it, it was water-soluble.
Oh, God.
So that was my first sales experience. But there was another thing that happened on that trip that was absolutely brilliant. I ended up meeting with the CEO of the then, and I'm not going to mention the name of the person or the company, but the largest food company in the United States. And he and I ended up in this hour discussion that turned out to be one of the most inspirational moments of my life. I told him, you know, I showed him the tea, and I told him about going out and picking the tea and how I felt that the world needed, America needed good, healthy food, and that health came from eating natural products. At that point, there had been things like companies inventing Tang and sending it with the astronauts. And he was convinced that the way to get healthy food and good production was to make it all out of chemicals. So we got in this, what turned out to be a very heated discussion about natural versus chemicals. And at the end of about an hour, he said to me, "Why don't you give up your goofy tea idea and get a real job and come work for me at X company?" Well, for the next number of years, when we didn't have money for payroll and I wasn't sure we'd be around the next day, I'd think about this CEO telling me to give up my goofy tea company and everything was going to be made out of chemicals. That was the other line. He said, "All the food is going to be made out of chemicals." And I was inspired to get up that day and tough it out and make the payroll and keep moving forward.
Well, I tell you what, and again, listeners, if you're just joining us, all the way from beautiful Colorado is Mo Siegel, one of the co-founders in 1970 of Celestial Seasonings. And I have no doubt, you know, over the last 40-plus years that they've been around, that most of you have had any one of their teas, including either Sleepy Time or Red Zinger, and the list can go on and on. And one of the things I marvel at, and why I really also wanted to get Mo on, and I'm so thankful that we have him today, is that he and his partners actually created, you know, the modern tea industry, this herbal industry, this, you know, and it's not every day you talk to someone who actually started an industry. But you know what, Mo, you had a dream. And, you know, sometimes I call them dream snatchers. And, you know, you meet those people. And in the end, as you kind of say in your own way, they invigorate you. They inspire you. They make you even want it more, where subconsciously, you know, he's running the largest company of its kind. And you want to say, you know what, I'll show you. And lo and behold, you did. So now it's, you know, 72. You've incorporated. Maybe you could take us through, you know, as it started, the business really started to take off here, and eventually, you know, you got an offer you couldn't even refuse at the age of 34.
Yeah, so the company just boomed. It was great. There was, in 1974, this actress, Susan St. James, had written and said, "I like to ski in Colorado. I'd love to come out and meet you. I love your products." She came. We needed money. She had a little bit of money to invest in us. And I thought, well, boy, that you're getting it at such a great deal. I'm not sure I like this deal. But she said, "Don't worry, I will make up for the price." She called about 2 months later and said, "Watch Johnny Carson tonight." She goes out on Johnny Carson. My old friend John Denver was hosting the show. And she comes out with a tray of Red Zinger. And John says, "What do you got, Susan?" And Susan says, "Red Zinger tea." And John goes, "Red Zinger tea, far out, far out." And the next morning, all those supermarkets that would never call us back were on the telephone going, "We need that Red Zinger tea." So that was just a lucky break. And then the company just grew and grew and grew. And then in 1978, our world changed. In Lipton, for years, there was this guy, their head tea taster, had been, when interviewed and discussing Celestial Seasonings, he would say, "Well, Celestial is, it's the weeds by the swamp." Because they were just selling plain old regular tea, and he didn't particularly like peppermint and spearmint and all Camel Mile and all this other stuff. So he described us as the weeds by the swamp. Well, one day Lipton woke up and said, "The weeds by the swamp are really gaining market share. This is serious. We've got to come out with our own product line." So before we knew it, they went from no specialty tea in the stores, just their regular Lipton tea, to, they were in 80% of the stores within a six-month period. And the team that had been with me from 1971 to 78, almost everybody left the company, or most of the people, the executives. It was just not the company that they wanted to be a part of, because it was a place where we had serious competition. The end of the volleyball games at lunch had come. We actually had to do strategic planning and funny things like that. My dear friend John left, and the company had to be completely reinvented, because before we knew it, when Lipton entered the market that year, we were only in 15% of the supermarkets. We were in all the grocery stores, in all the natural food stores, but 15% of the grocery stores, and they're up at 80% in 6 months, and they buried us. Net-net, a new team came in, and by the end of it, in 1981, when they quit spending millions of dollars advertising, we were outselling them 3-1 in the supermarkets. So the company completely transformed itself. Some really brilliant people came in, people that had extensive packaged goods experience with the Pepsis of the world and the Proctors, and the company just boomed. It was great. And then in 1984, I got an offer from Kraft. I was 34 years old, and I'd been at the company now. I'd started when I was 19. I was 15 years in, and it was a great offer to buy the company, so I sold it. But then, lo and behold, and actually a guy took my place as president, and that was guy Barney Feinblum, who had been my CFO. So in 1988, Lipton tries to buy Celestial Seasonings from Kraft. And in the meantime, Kraft was bought by a cigarette company, by Philip Morris, which was just, in my mind, I couldn't believe that my company had ended up with a cigarette company. And Barney led a leveraged buyout, matched Lipton's price, and bought the company back. And at that point, I became an investor again, came back on the board. So I was out for about 2.5 years, came back on the board, and then in 91 came back in and ran the company day-to-day again. And then we did well, and we went public in 93, and then in 2000, we got another great offer. And at this point, I've pretty much spent most of my adult life running this company. We got a great offer with a company called Hain, and the two companies merged together as Hain Celestial and became the largest natural foods producer in North America. And I stayed for a couple of years, and then in 2002 left, and have been doing lots of other things ever since.
Well, I tell you what.
So it's been a great, wonderful journey with brilliant, fun, good people. And what's been, Mitch, the thing that's made me so happy is that the dream of seeing people eat good, healthy food and people growing natural and organic food and taking chemicals out of the food and just eating real food and staying healthy and having a chance to be healthy and taking care of their bodies and exercising and all the good stuff associated with good food has been a total joy. And the natural foods industry, when it started, was really, the food didn't taste very good. But you go into a Whole Foods store today, and the food is gourmet, delicious, brilliant tasting, and it's healthy. And that transformation has made this industry work, and that was one of the keys to Celestial. We said in the very beginning, we want this. I wanted the tea to be so good that even if you didn't like healthy kind of stuff, you'd drink it because it tasted so good. So you'd be tricked into drinking healthy products. And the strategy worked, and that strategy, and really led by Whole Foods, has been what's transformed the natural foods business.
Well, you have been at the forefront of this, and as I mentioned earlier, and again, listeners, if you're just tuning in, we've got Mo Siegel, the co-founder of Celestial Seasonings, on it with us, and We're talking about his journey here and much, much more. But one of the things, Mo, as I said, you know, you started a whole industry here. And I have no doubt, and you and I both know this, that there's certain times during the journey where, you know, you're sometimes, you know, wondering what in the world is going on and how did this happen? And, you know, even again, that fear of maybe even losing this thing, you know, it's 1983 and, you know, and all of a sudden there's a recall of 6,000 cases of Comfrey tea and you were getting ready to go public and that gets pulled back and then Lipton and so on and so forth. And in the end, and why I bring this up is it really is amazing how things work out for the better. You know, when you're in the middle of that storm, you can't figure out why. And then you look back, you know, how could my friends leave me? You know, we built this thing. Things got tough. You're all running on me now. And it turns out that the new people that came in took it to a whole nother level. And the reason I bring this up is not only to share this with our listeners, but more importantly, I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about from your voice firsthand, how you got through these tough times.
First of all, I think if you're mission focused, you just assume that times are going to be tough and there's good times and bad times. And if you've got a mission, then it's a lot easier to go with the hard times. And if your mission, which is, I'm not that kind of person at all, but I'm not a person that lives for money. So my mission was to see people getting healthy and bringing the healthiest, great tasting tea possible. And so when things were tough, I'd just look at the mission and be totally invigorated. And the tough times really didn't bother me that much. It was just fine. And really, Mitch, there were... I lived on food stamps my first 3 years at Celestial. And there were times where we couldn't meet payroll. And the Comfrey recall that you talked about was just absolutely terrible. It could have crippled the company. And it was hard. There is no rose-colored glasses that would say that thing was easy. But, you know, there's nothing in the world worth accomplishing that's easy. And it's, you got to feast on uncertainty and fatten on disappointment. Most of the things that I've learned, most of the wisdom and values that I've learned have come through trials and tribulations, not through success. So when things were the toughest, like when, you know, when Lipton came after us, they could have buried us. I mean, gone, overdone. And it invigorated us to do something new and different and to be a lot better than we were before. And if they hadn't come along and darn near buried us, we might not have ever done nearly as well as we did.
And that's what I was alluding to, Mo, is that in the end, it works out for the better. And, you know, I know that you do a lot of public speaking, and it makes me think about, you know, one of those titles, you know, that you speak about. And, you know, the reality of that sometimes getting into hot water brings out the best in you.
Life is like a good cup of tea. Getting in hot water brings out your true flavor. Absolutely. Don't you think?
I agree with you 100%. And that's one of the great things as we both start to get older here. And, you know, you look back on the journey and you realize you learn so much about who you are. And, you know, one of the things I love about you also is obviously, you know, you love to give back. And there's lots of things that you're involved in. You're on many boards, including Whole Food Markets board, as well as I know. And you do a lot of investing with your firm, you know, Twin Peaks. And I thought maybe as we start to wrap up here a little bit, Mo, you could talk a little bit about, and as you said, you know, it's not about the money, Mitch, but maybe you could talk a little bit about making a life while making a living.
Yeah, thank you for that question. You know, it was interesting. I had this wonderful experience when I was, I don't know, I think it was 26, and I'd flown to New York City to see a really large private equity company, and I met the first billionaire I'd ever met. And I flew in on the 23rd, had a meeting the morning of the 24th of December. And at that point, I had three kids. And I went into this company, and I'd never met a billionaire before, so I was pretty surprised and impressed. And the offices were so plush and absolutely gorgeous, richly appointed to the hilt. And that morning started snowing like crazy. And I kept looking out the window of the building thinking, I'm going to get stuck at LaGuardia. I'm not going to get home for Christmas. And I'm here for money. And the building started emptying out. And this billionaire just kept staying and staying. And I'm spending a lot of time with him. And our company at that point is like $5 million in sales or, you know, some dinky nothing. $6 million, $8 million, I don't know. And I'm thinking, well, why is he staying here? The building is almost empty. So he had another guy that is the guy that I had been introduced to and had been working with and had been taking me through the place. And Ned and I are talking. And so finally I said, Ned, the building's almost empty. It's snowing like crazy. Christmas Eve tonight. What are you doing tonight? And he said, well, I really don't have much I'm doing. And I said, what about your kids? He said, they don't talk to me. And we talked for a while, and then I asked him about this other man, the billionaire, and he said, he's had multiple divorces. He's got a bad family. And all of a sudden, I looked around the room and the building and thought, what be it if you gain the whole world and lose your own soul? And I thought about my three kids back home. And I said, I got to go. I got to go to the airport. And I left. And got on that plane, and I thought, I will never, if possible, forsake my family for money. And I made sure I never scheduled trips again like that one. And I felt like it was a great lesson because I could have, you know, I had all the money, and we're all different. Everybody's different. But for me, the values of having good children and spending time with my children and raising them was more important than making the money. So it taught me, I think that experience with the lonely billionaire taught me that there's just way more to life than chasing money. And you need money, and money's good, and work is good, and so many things are good. But having a family, to me, if I could achieve anything, raising of good children would be the best achievement I could make.
Well, I know that's extremely important to you, and it's such a great lesson to learn. And you know what's really amazing, Mo, is that eventually, as you and I both know, the money came. I mean, you know, you have more money than you ever would have dreamed of when you were on food stamps, but the reality was you knew you were going to make it, and you said it best, mission, and the mission you were on and why you did it. And lo and behold, 40 years later, the company does, you know, 100 plus million in sales, and, you know, you've done well, and you've made an industry here, and it's a lot more than tea. I mean, that's the bottom line. You know, people are eating better than ever, and you're at the forefront of this. Well, in wrapping up, Mo, I got one last question, and that is obviously, you know, you've been this entrepreneur your whole life. You invest today. You are on nonprofits. There's lots of things. You've done those 14,000-foot-plus Colorado peaks, all, I guess, 55 of them. And, you know, you've lived a glorious life. You started this car race that went on to be big. I mean, and we only got a small taste for Mo Siegel. But my question to you is, you know, if you had to do it all over again, you know, what would you do differently? And is there anything that you wish you knew, you know, then that you know now?
My friend John Mackey, the CEO of Whole Foods, had been running Whole Foods for a long time, and he got to a place where he'd kind of been tired of it. He wasn't tired of the company, he loves the company, but he just needed a break. And John went and took a long walk. He hiked the Appalachian Trail, took a sabbatical. And I guess if I look back at Celestial, maybe maybe I shouldn't have sold the company. It was the first time to craft, but when you start with no money, everything is a fight to have, you know, to wake up and open the doors the next day, because I couldn't have started poorer. So I got a few friends that have got really good-sized companies that they're passing on to future generations, and it turns out that my kids, they're all pretty good at business, and some of them are really good. And maybe if I could say anything to an entrepreneur building a company, before you sell your company, think carefully, take a long walk. Because maybe in 1984, I should have taken a long walk. But at that point, the die was cast, because when we bought the company back from Kraft, we spent so much money, we were so in debt, we had no choice but to go public. And then after we went public, there was the offer with the Hain Celestial Company to be the biggest natural foods company was a great offer. But if I had to do it over, I might have taken a walk in 1984, gotten away for a few months, and then come back invigorated instead of selling the company.
I tell you what, Mo, some really, really great advice. And as my listeners know, I say this a lot. Again, listeners, you've been listening to Let's Talk Business right here on WREK 91.1 on your FM dial. And we've had on none other than the wonderful entrepreneur, Mo Siegel. And Mo, I never know where the time goes here, but hopefully you enjoyed yourself today.
Hey, Mitch, thanks for inviting me. It's been a real pleasure to be with you and be in Boulder, Colorado with deep snow in Atlanta at the same time.
Well, let's use this as a starting point, and let's stay in touch, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. Again, listeners, get a chance to go out and Google Mo Siegel. Mo is short for Morris. That's his name, and you're going to learn a lot from all the stories out there and the things that have been written about him. He's got five great kids, a bunch of grandkids, and he's still doing a lot of good out there. He's an entrepreneur who we all need to continue to learn from. I want to thank, of course, my first guest, Shep Hyken. Go get his book, The Amazement Revolution. And I want to thank, of course, all the people that make this show possible. I want to thank, of course, our producer here, Fred. I want to thank everyone here at WREK, Jonathan and Grace and everyone. And, of course, the people that make this show possible, everyone at Accent, our Ultimate Life Institute, and even our Magic Wand Foundation. You're listening to our marvelous Ultimate Life Radio Network. And if you ever have any needs and you need any support during the week, always feel free to send email to mitch@ltbn.com. That's mitch@ltbn.com. Bye-bye now.